Can you hear me?
We have some technical difficulties, so now we got your phone cracking, right?
Yeah,
I'm gonna say your phone is high quality.
You like that?
It's like you're looking at me and you have a serious statement to make.
Yeah, I do, man. I do. You know what even makes it more serious?
That full grown beard.
What's up?
You look like somebody's daddy.
I know, right? Hey, that's the look we don't want. Man, no, I'm gonna shave this thing off right now.
Oh my God.
Dad, every time you walk through another room and your kids see you, it's just the fear of that daddy beard. You got something to say. I want you kids.
Oh man.
I was supposed to do the intro, but I got distracted by the daddy beard.
I know, man. I apologize. I'm going to shave this off a little bit later.
We need intelligent and authoritative figures.
Okay.
I'm with it. Go ahead and lead. That's all I'm saying, my brother.
But how come none of the leaders, like none of the presidents, have beards? You ever notice that? Why are they always clean shaven?
We need to bring back the beard, bro.
Yeah, we got to bring the beard back.
Yeah,
because there's no everybody's like clean shaven. Yeah, it's not working. Nothing good is coming from this clean shaven look, man.
At least get the 5 o'clock shadow.
Exactly.
Like, hey, I got your back. I've been in it. You know, I know I don't have all the answers, but as you see by my beard, I've been putting in the time.
It's a tough time. Like, why would you be clean shaven right now? How do you have time? How do you have time to be clean shaven when people don't have jobs? I don't understand.
You need to use that shaving time thought. Time. Did that even make sense? The shaving time, thought time.
Yeah.
Not shaving.
Thank you.
There it is.
Period.
Shaving time, thought time, not shaving. Thank you.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm with you. Yeah.
I'm glad. It's been a while, bro. I'm glad we back. You know, I say we had a healthy pause. Would you think?
I think we did. And I think it was, in some ways it was important that we did that. Obviously a lot of people who listen to us for other reasons than football, but a lot of times they do listen to us for football, and it wasn't the time to be really discussing football at this particular juncture. It wasn't the time. So I wanted to, you know, and we wanted to give our people a little bit of time to kind of relax, breathe, you know, let all the other things in the world that were going on, you know, let them really absorb all that first. You know, and then we can get back into this, man, because we're going to talk a little bit about football today, and we're going to talk about, you know, a bunch of other things also, as we usually do. But, you know, we had to give them time to really adjust to the new way of the world, so to speak.
I feel like, you know, in our discussions, we personally go back in the laboratory and our the laboratory of how we think about things, and we discuss things, and we try to shape not a narrative, but a process of thinking about the current events before we just start going off at the mouth and having an opinion. You know, and it was a lot of things happening that we needed to just pause, man. So let's think about things. Let's have some discussions. But it also makes it so entertaining when we get back on the mic.
Yeah. I got some good news for you though, Jason.
Tell me, my brother.
I got some really good news for you.
Okay.
I think in the year 2050, we're in 2020 now, right?
Yeah.
By the year 2050, the United States of America is going to be as close to a perfect society as we have in this world.
Really?
By the year 2050. Absolutely. And I'm going to get into the reasons why later on in the podcast. Not right now.
Okay.
But by the year 2050, I want you to remember this, because hopefully we'll still be alive by then. Hopefully.
Man, I need to be, man. This six-year-old is working me.
Yeah. 2050, the United States of America will be as close to a perfect society as we can get to. But that's a topic for another conversation. That's a little bit later, man. We're going to get to that. I'm going to need about 6 minutes to fully break it down to you, J-Bell.
Yes.
6 minutes to fully break it down to you. And then I think maybe you see where I'm going once we get there, all right?
Okay. I need Simon's help on this. Simon, let me know when OC's 6 minutes needs to start, because I just want to roll with it.
Yeah.
I like this. I was thinking about something.
Mm.
And you know, I always like to start the podcast. I don't know if you know I like to do this. I kind of sneak it in. But I always have a question for you, something that I would ask you, but I use it on the podcast because I like your thought process. And my question is, you've had a lot of challenges in life, stepped up to adversity or challenges in your own way, and you've had success and you've had failures, progressed through them, and become a better man on the other side. And I want to know, how do you handle something that hasn't gone well for you?
Yeah.
How have you handled something that doesn't happen?
Yeah.
We keep telling people in these trying times, you know, use this time to do this and do that and be a better person and evolve and all this kind of stuff. Give me some actionable steps. Like, how has that process happened?
Yeah. Jason, that is a very, very tough question to answer. And the reason why I'll say that is because everybody's born with a different, you know, mindset. Like our genes and genetics in some form or fashion, you know, kind of shape the way we think and a lot of things. So for me, I don't know what it is. I don't know what it is, Jason. I promise you, I wish I could give you an answer. But for me, there's always been something inside me that told me things were going to be okay. It's always been there. Like, and I can't explain it, but it's always been there. Something inside me was always telling me, you're going to be fine. Don't worry. You're going to be fine. I remember when I first got to America and I was living in the projects, basically. Section 8 housing. Poor. Didn't have nothing. Something always would tell me inside, something was like, don't worry, you're going to be fine. Don't worry about it. You're going to be all right. And so I never really, even though I was poor and I didn't have nothing, I was never stressing. Like, never. I'm going to tell you a real funny story, Jason. I was in Troy State University, right? This is going to trip you out. it just goes to like a mentality, man. And there's literally no way I can answer the question you asked me because I don't take responsibility for what has happened in my life. I really don't. Like, I've worked hard, yes, but there's just been an element of pure luck. And so I was at Troy and, you know, I had got like my Pell Grant money, you know, the Pell Grant that they would give you, you know, all that stuff. And I had went and I had bought a car, you know, a Cadillac, you know, it was a Cadillac Sedan DeVille, an 89.
Jason. Ooh.
It was candy red. You know,
that's clean.
You know, I'd save, you know, I'd put rims on there. I had the speakers. I had the little wood wheel, J-Bell. I used to wash this car almost every day. I was so proud of this car, J-Bell. So one day me and my boys, we come back to the dormitory. And so I go back into the room, you know, I sleep. And then it's time for us to go to practice. I come outside and my boy Shelton, you know, we both go outside. And Shelton is like, where's your car? I'm like, what do you mean by where's your car? He's like, Osi, where's your car? And I look outside, J-Bell, my car is gone.
Oh, game over.
Stolen car. They came to my dorm, right? All this money, and you know, money was,
it was scarce. It was scarce. Right?
Everything, I'd put everything into this car, and just like that, J-Bell, they stole my car. They found it a couple of weeks later. They took everything off of it, burnt it to a crisp, everything. So I remember that same day, Jason, this is no BS. You know, so I'm not riding in my boy's car to practice, right? And we go to practice and, you know, outside and I'm practicing. Everything is normal. And so Shelton comes to me. He's like, OC, stop it, man. Why are you pretending like this is okay? Why are you pretending that you're not bothered by this? But oddly enough, for some weird reason, right when it happened, I was like, it's okay, I'm gonna have better cars than this. That was my thought process. It was like, it's okay, no worries, I'm gonna have better cars than this. I was unbothered by what had just happened. Now, I can tell you, oh, yes, it's because, well, there's no explanation for why I would think like that. I wasn't on the radar of any NFL team. I didn't know I was going to get drafted. Nothing. This was like my – I wasn't even a junior in school at this point.
Yeah, you weren't even on the map, really.
NFL wasn't even a possibility, but something inside me just told me, don't worry, it's going to be okay. You're going to do better than this. And guess what? It happened. So I can't explain to you how, you know, I've dealt with, you know, setback after setback or problem after problem. Or the only thing I can tell you is there's just something inside me that's, it's almost like there's somebody looking out, you know, for me. Something in the universe that's just guiding me towards something that could be seen as a setback, and just knowing it's not a setback. This is going to work out in your favor. That's the only answer I got.
So Pete Carroll, who is a fan of you.
All right, yeah.
Coach of the Seattle Seahawks. He just had a book come out called Compete to Greatness. And he did it with this psychologist who does stuff with the Seattle Seahawks. And now we both spoke to Russell Wilson. And you speak to him, you're like, dude can't be this optimistic.
Right.
Right? You're just like, dude can't be this optimistic. Yeah. After understanding how the players in Seattle are now, and the players that were there, there's a reason why a Pete Carroll likes OC. Mm. There is something about being optimistic that gives you the ability to just keep going forward. Mm. Teaching yourself, if you don't have that, teach yourself to understand that things have worked out for you before.
Yeah.
If you just, because you wouldn't be standing here alive, you know? And so in these trying times, when things are just crazy, it's chaos, you know, there is a sense of order that's in the eye of the storm. Being optimistic will guide you through these trying times. I think it's just, I just look at people that seem to be happy and seem to grind through and make things happen. And they just, the grind is the process. Things might not work out where they stand, but tomorrow is another challenge, and be present in that moment.
I think you're 100% correct, right? It has to be like a real belief, you know, oh, I'm just going to fake it till I make it.
No.
You have to literally believe that with every, you know, thing. It's like, oh, it's going to get better. And it's almost as if you tell the universe in some sort of, without sounding crazy.
Yep.
It's almost as if you kind of transport that, and it manifests itself into like real positive things happening for you, man. It's so strange. So strange. And another thing is also just understanding, you know, situations and understanding people, man. But we'll get into that a little bit later too.
Yep. I think you can only control what you think.
Yeah.
Because we both know people that had probably a ton of material wealth and that are miserable.
Yeah.
Control how you respond to things and be present, and feel like that gives us a chance. I'm trying to do it more every day. So I wanna ask you about something that's kind of important in NFL.
Okay.
It's something that happens that when you're in a locker room and it happens to somebody, especially your guy, he comes in and he's chilling and he's like, whatever. But the locker room just gets loud. It buzzing. Just gets crazy. Buzzing. Just, you buzzing. Can feel it. And that is when your boy gets paid. When your boy gets that chinchilla, that Bradzilla, he gets that dodo. You come in and you are pumped up for your guy. You know, you are just so excited. And biggest deal in NFL history.
Yeah.
And sports. In the U.S., right? Your homie Mahomes.
That is my homie,
Now, this is not a surprise. We knew it was going to happen.
Yeah.
Let's talk about that. But we know he deserves it.
Mm-hmm.
We know why. He's young. He's the guy. But what does it do? What's happening to Pat Mahomes right now? Like, we know he's cool. Everybody talks about him. The coolest dude ever. I know guys that work with him that everybody loves him.
Yeah.
What's happening right now?
It's a indescribable feeling, I would say, especially when you're talking about that level of wealth, you know? Like, this is transcendent money. You know, you're talking about $500 million? $500 million, bro. this is a ridiculous amount of money, man. And then the security and, you know, the just the knowing that at your age, you're 25, 26, I don't even know how old you are.
24.
24. You never have to work a day in your life again. Not only you, maybe your parents, your kids, their kids, and possibly their kids.
Yeah.
And it's almost an indescribable feeling, man, of just having that amount of wealth, man. And you know the work you put in. You know all the stuff. Just literally imagine something that you've been dreaming of your whole life, like literally going to sleep and you sleep and you dream of this and you wake up and it's a reality, like this actually happened. And it's hard to describe, man. One thing I will say is I've heard in regards to Mahomes' contract, I've heard people saying, oh, the contract was too long, you know, or he could have got more money if he would have done shorter term deals and all this type of stuff. Cool, right? I understand all that. But the one thing that I've come to realize is when you're dealing in those kind of numbers, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter anymore. There's no difference between somebody who's making $40 million a year and somebody who's making $45 million. They're living the exact same life, I promise you. Somebody who has $1 million and somebody who has $2 million, they're living the same life. Somebody who has $10 million and somebody who has $20 million, they're living the same life. There's no difference once the numbers start to get up that high. So squabbling over the length of contract here or, you know, a couple of million, none of that means anything to this guy at this particular juncture. None of that means anything to any of these guys who are making that kind of money. It shouldn't anyway. And which is the issue that I have with what's going on with Dak Prescott right now. It's the issue that I have with that. I'm not saying that Dak isn't worth whatever it is he's asking for. He 100% is. I hope they give him the moon. You understand? Because he deserves whatever they're going to pay him. But once you start negotiating numbers at that level, the security that you're going to get from signing a longer-term, big-money deal that the Cowboys are apparently willing to give him, it's not worth haggling over one or two or three extra $1 million a year. It's not worth it, man, because in the grand scheme of things, at the end of the day, that money is not going to make – it's not going to make a difference in your life at all. It's not going to make a difference in your family's life. You're getting paid $30 million as opposed to getting paid $33 million a year. It's not going to make one bit of difference in your life. And you probably can't see that now. It's difficult to see that now because obviously there's pride, there's ego. You want to get paid what you're worth, and you should. So you can't see that now. But like when you leave – or, you know, later on in your life, you're like, man, am I really, really wasn't worth it, man. None of this worth it, man. It's just not. Secure yourself as best as you can. That's all I can say.
I think they're fighting over 1 year or something of that nature.
Why would you do that?
I think because, well, this is my thought process. I'm not a cap guy, but I will, without using names, I remember a linebacker for a really good team. They won Super Bowls. Mm-hmm. Taking a deal that was very team friendly.
Yep.
And it destroyed the linebacker market for all the other guys that were free agents because they said, are you as good as this guy? Mm-hmm. And people couldn't argue with that. They weren't. Mm-hmm. But he set the bar.
Okay.
And everybody else felt the pain because he didn't set the market. Now, Pat Mahomes set the market.
Yep.
Dak Prescott situation, in my opinion.
Yes.
When Dallas didn't sign him last year during the year.
Yes.
Okay. Right? It's time, value, and money. Right? Mm-hmm. Time, value, money. It all works good. Mm-hmm. I said, the cards just shifted to Dak Prescott's favor. You know why? Mm-hmm. because of Kirk Cousins. Kirk Cousins showed if you have patience, you got to get paid. And you don't even have to be the best. You get paid, you get a shorter deal, and you don't even have to be the best. The scale tipped in Dak Prescott's favor because Dallas and the longer they waited. Now with Pat Mahomes' deal out there, it's just for Dak, it's getting better and better and better. And his position strength, to me, comes from length of contract.
I hear what you're saying. I do. I really do.
Yeah.
Let me ask you a question. Do you have as much confidence in Dak Prescott as you do in Deshaun Watson or Patrick Mahomes?
No.
So what are we talking about?
It's just the market, but he's one of the best. One thing I do like about Dak, okay, can I give him some credit?
Look at my smile.
I know. Stop. Good. The daddy beard, you know, hey, it's, you know what I feel like? I'm about to lie. I feel like I got caught. It's the beard, man. That thing is intimidating, bro.
I know, man.
5 o'clock shadow is powerful. Can't even focus. What was I saying about Dak? I was saying, when the game's on the line or it's a tight throw, the dude is game for the big time environment, the big time pressure. And I love that in the quarterback.
I hear you. Yeah. I do. And I think you're right. You know, I really enjoy this guy as a player. I think he's really good. I don't think he's Patrick Mahomes. And so I don't think that he can get paid the way a Patrick Mahomes would get paid. I agree. I don't.
So without a doubt,
if that's the case, you're the quarterback for the Dallas Cowboys. If they're offering you, and I don't know what they're offering. I don't. But if they're offering you upwards of $30 million a year to be the quarterback of the Dallas Cowboys for 5-6 years, just from what I've seen from a long-term point of view, it's better to do that. It's better to stay there. I'm not telling you to take a team-friendly cap print, all that nonsense. I'm not telling you to do any of that. But I'm saying from a long-term point of view, it's better to not leave the Dallas Cowboys and go somewhere else next year or whatever. It's better to secure some type of security with them, even though you might be able to take a little bit less money because you're going to make that money long-term, period. You're going to get that back.
That's one thing about being a Cowboy. You're right. And Jerry Jones knows that. Dak got the Campbell Soup deal. He's got all kind of big deals. You know, it's the quarterback of the Cowboys. And if you're a quarterback for the Dallas Cowboys, you know you got a television job as soon as you're done.
Lined up.
As long as you can breathe.
I mean, come on. There's just too many. There's too many advantages.
It is
too many advantages. Yeah, look at my man. OBJ. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I mean, being in New York. Oh my God, a guy like that, he's a superstar. I'm talking about like everything about this
man. On and off the field.
Superstar. You understand what I'm trying to say? He belongs in New York.
I hear you.
I hate to say it. I have no problem with Cleveland. Shout out to the Cleveland Browns. Shout out to the Dog Pound. Shout out to all of them. But a guy like that in New York is different than a guy like that in Cleveland. It's just different. It's different.
New York made him. The biggest catch.
Well, I'll say that.
In New York.
Yeah.
You know, on that stage, that's when everybody saw this kid was going to be special.
And
the reason that happened, because it was a primetime game against Dallas.
Giants.
Night game. I'm just me. You know, I go to New York, and all of a sudden, my Nike contract gets doubled. And I'm like, what happened? And my agent was like, you're in New York.
That's what happened.
I ain't made one play for the Giants. My Nike contract doubled. You are in New York, son.
Yeah, man. So get that paper, man. Also, shout out to my man, Miles Garrett.
Miles Garrett, Chris Jones.
Chris Jones. Get him broke off. Miles Garrett, honestly, best defensive end in football right now, in my opinion.
He's getting better, too.
Jason. I like last year, you know, before the whole incident happened, I was just like, let me just watch this cat. Because before that, I really wasn't completely sold on him. I really wasn't. But I watched this guy with the Browns last year. Jason.
Monster.
Oh my God. Jason, he was dominating people. I'm talking about like terrifying. This guy was a terrifying defensive end. I'm not saying he was the best pass rusher. To me, that's still Miller. You know, I'm not saying he's the best run, but as an overall defensive end, he was the most dominant defensive end in football while he was playing, period. He's the highest paid defensive end in football right now, and he deserves to be the highest paid defensive end in football right now. He's the most dominant defensive end we have in the game right now. No question about it.
He's young. He's getting better.
The ends, yep.
It's that important. And then you see Derrick Henry getting paid, and people were kind of wondering about, you know, running backs. Always remember this, and we have this discussion. He is the identity of their team.
Yep, smash mouth.
He is a part of that culture, what they are. So, yeah, he's a running back. Yeah, you can all this, how you value running backs and how many years they got left. Listen, he is what they do. And that's the thing about the NFL. If you fit the identity of a team.
You get taken care of.
Regardless, because that's what they do. And that's how they do it. And that's why things shift when coaching changes happen.
Also, you know, speaking of Derrick Henry's deal, man, you know who I'm really starting to really like as a person? I want you to pay attention to Ryan Tannehill and the things he says.
All right.
I'm not talking about as a player.
Uh-huh.
I just want you to just take some time, right, and follow what Ryan Tannehill says.
Are you saying he's on the right side of history?
100%. 100%. Mm-hmm. This guy has his teammates back. Like, yes, he has his teammates back. You know, it's easy for you to get paid and then, you know, kind of like, yeah, we'll let the team handle that. Nah, man. He's not about that. He is like, you need to do this. You need to take care of this. He's putting himself out there, man, for his teammates. And, you know, when you see a quarterback who does that, you just have to love him because there's so many of them who don't.
Yep. Skinner.
Not these guys. These guys now are like, they are about that action, J-Bell. They really are. And I like it. I love it.
That's a good point. I think you're going to see this play out on the field. Mm-hmm. I think the teams, because of what we have been through as a society as a whole, I think the bonds that have been developed by certain players and their behavior collectively, how they view each other, how they view each other collectively as a whole. When you get on the field, OC, you know, when you care, when you know they care about you, it's dangerous on that field.
It is.
It is. You will lay it on the line.
Yep.
Because it's not about football.
Mm-hmm.
It's about the person.
Mm-hmm.
You are boys. You are brothers. Like, there is a bond. And you saw it on the field. You won Super Bowls because of that.
Yeah.
You're going to see teams. You're going to see how they play together. And it's almost going to be like when you were in high school where it was that element of – it was family. You know, nobody was getting cut.
Yeah.
You know, nobody was getting cut. So I think that you're going to see teams that have a tight bond. I think it'll be apparent. I think you're on to something.
Yeah, I agree, man. It's almost like when I had I remember I went to Iraq and I was starting to have conversations with people in the military, like soldiers, Marines. And they would compare, you know, their units to, you know, football and, you know, some of the things that we do. But there was one thing that this guy told me that really struck me because I never really had thought of it that way. He was like when we're there, like when we're out there fighting for life and death, we're not fighting for the United States military.
Hmm.
Like, they don't see themselves. They're literally fighting for the guy right next to them.
Yes.
They are fighting for the people in their unit. Like, they are laying their lives down, not necessarily for the United States military. They're laying their lives down for their people, their brothers, their sisters, the people who they've trained with, who they've been through hell with. And they do not want to let those people down, more so than they don't want to let the United States military down. And when I was like, wow, can you imagine what it would be like to be in that situation, in a life or death situation with somebody? Can you imagine the bond that comes from from doing that. Can you imagine how you think about these people who are literally living and dying for you? It's a completely different level of trust and bond. And so, yeah, you're right. Like, we're playing for each other. Oh, my boy Stray, my boy Tuck, Eli. Oh, we're gonna ball for these guys. And
yes,
that's, I think, what makes the best teams. You're right.
I knew what my role was on every team I played on, and I wasn't the top tier guy, but I knew the one or two plays I had to make a game, I didn't want to let y'all down.
Yeah.
Like, you had to make 9-10 plays. I had to do one thing right one time. Didn't want to let my boys down. You know, and that's powerful. And I think you see some of these societal norms that are being challenged and things people are being asked to do, right? that are inconvenient.
Yeah.
And when you make it about something that isn't you, it's a lot easier to do those things.
Yeah.
When it's not about you.
Yeah.
It's about the person next to you. Do you care about something bigger than yourself?
Okay. I'm glad you said that, because
What did I do?
It's a perfect segue.
I love it.
Because
can I take a sip of water?
Please.
Because I have a feeling I just need to hydrate.
Please.
Okay.
Because
if you rub that beard one more time, I'm just gonna quit. I'm out of here.
Like, I've got like a full beard, right? I'm doing like I got a full beard. I'm like, yeah, no. My stuff is all patchy, but I'm rubbing this, it like.
Hey,
like
you see, I got it. Go ahead.
Do people really care? This is the $1 trillion question. Do people really care? Because I believe that they do. After doing a lot of soul searching and research and coming to understand, you know, quite a few things, this has been like a really, really interesting time. Mm-hmm. It really is.
I agree.
And the question now is, okay, there's a lot of the protests that are still going on. You know, a lot of people are, you know, pledging to do this and pledging to do all these different things. But are they really addressing the root of the problem? Are they really getting into what needs to be fixed? Because in my estimation, J-Bell, I don't think that they really are. And there's valid reasons for that. There really are valid reasons for it. And I'm not just saying this as a Black person. I'm saying this because I always put myself in everybody else's shoes. I love to think, like, so for instance, I like to think, like, if I was a white person, how would I react? If I was Chinese, how would I react? So I like to think like them to see if I can understand where they're coming from. It makes me empathetic to everybody in some weird reason. And so, you know, you could look at me like, oh, you're not for these people, or you're not for Black people, you're not for white people. But for me, it's just, I'm just able to see things from so many different perspectives, maybe because of the way I've lived. And so now I started to think, okay, we as human beings, right, we are visual, which means, you know, we're visceral people. So somebody can tell you something over and over and you believe it, right? But then once you start to see differently, your mind starts to change because this is what you've seen. I'll give you an example. When I was growing up in Nigeria, right, the only thing I knew about Asian people was Bruce Lee, you know, like fighting. That was literally the only thing I knew about Asian people in general. It was just Bruce Lee fighting me. It was ignorant, but this was all I knew. So I come to the United States of America and, you know, I start to interact, like actually interacting with Asian people. I'm like, oh my God, these are the smartest people in my class. Number one, you know, you start to see them in their communities. They're strong. They're very family oriented. You see their countries highly developed in every way. So now my impression and my idea of Asian people went from Chinese, you know, fighting and Kung Fu and Bruce Lee to these are very serious people. You understand what I mean? And they are to be respected for everything that they've done. Jewish people also. And when I was in Nigeria, the only thing I knew about, you know, Jewish people was the Holocaust. That was it. that was the only, those are the only images of Jewish people that I saw. And then when I came to America, I started to see them. I'm like, man, people are brilliant. You know, they're strong people. You look at their country, very, very strong. You know, these people are dead serious. They're not playing around with anybody. You understand what I mean? They're very serious, good, strong people. And so my idea went from that to, okay, these are some very, very serious people, man. They're not to be messed with. That Holocaust, go try that now. Go see what happens. Go see what happens to you now if you try that. They'll finish you off. So what I'm saying is, as Black people, our poverty is reinforcing the stereotypes of us. Our poverty is reinforcing the stereotypes of us. You understand? The way they think of us. So you come to, you know, you see, oh, Black people are committing crimes and, you know, we're killing each other and we're doing, but why are we doing that? It's poverty. You understand? We're desperate. We're in very bad situations and we lash out. You understand what I'm trying to say? Because we haven't been given opportunities, you know, we're marginalized. All these things is a direct result of just being poor. And so the wealth disparity between whites and Blacks is so high that we're like at the bottom, and it's poverty that makes us act in the way that we act. And so here's what happens. We, you know, we're killing each other because we're poor. We're robbing, we're stealing, we're doing things that me, myself, I had to do when I was living in that situation. So I understand it clearly. You understand? And so we're doing all these things. And as long as the crime is contained within our communities, they don't really care about that. They're okay with that. But then it starts to leak out. It starts to leak out a little bit. And then now it becomes a real big problem. Now we're super predators. Now we're this, now we're that. And now guess what happens? Aggressive policing tactics. Oh, we gotta nip this in the bud. We gotta stop this. We're locking us up. We're doing all this stuff. And you send 100 police into a neighborhood, 5 or 10 of them are going to be terrible human beings, just percentage-wise. They're gonna be just horrible people, 5 or 10 of them. And so they do something ridiculous, atrocious, and we see that. And then some white people see that and we're like, oh, you can't have this, man. This is terrible. This is horrible. And so we protest. And so now they see that, and guess what happens? They're like, okay, maybe we shouldn't be so aggressive. Let's pull back a little bit. Let's, you know, stop doing these tactics. Maybe, you know, Black Lives Matter, all this stuff, right? But guess what hasn't happened, Jason? Nobody has addressed the poverty that made us act that way in the first place. Nobody has addressed that. So now they pull back, and guess what happens? We're still in that same situation. So we start back to killing each other. We start back to robbing, we start back to stealing, because we are still in the same situation as we were in before. And so guess what happens? Aggressive policing tactic. And the cycle repeats itself. That's why it seems to be happening in perpetuity. It keeps on happening because nobody has addressed fully the situations that are making us reinforce these stereotypes. Nobody has addressed fully the situations that have kept us down for so long. And so now, here's the problem. Here's why I say America is going to be as close as you get to a perfect society in 2050. Here's why I say that. We're here, me and you right now, we're in the United Kingdom, right? You know, I'm not even gonna say where you are, but I'm in London, we're in the United Kingdom, right? You have to understand that as much as we love it here because there's a sense of, you know, more freedom and all these things, but there's still a huge disparity between the wealth of the whites and the wealth of the Black people. Like Black people here, colored people, they're still marginalized. You know, no matter which way you slice and dice, they still are. And there's a big disparity there, right? But here's the problem, is that this country is 82% white. 82% white. In order to fix what's going on in the Black communities, this is going to cost tens, if not hundreds, of billions of pounds of pumping into education, you know, whatever it is. It's going to cost a tremendous amount of money to, quote unquote, make us whole, if you want, right? Or to get us at least on some sort of level playing field. A government will always cater first and foremost to its constituency. Like they have to do that. Like, and if a country is 82% white, you're gonna ask this government now to remove tens and hundreds of billions of pounds from the white community and pump it into the black community. And this is literally never going to happen here. It's just not going to happen. As much as we would like it to happen, they can do little things here and there, but what's really needed on a mass scale to really address the disparity between whites and black, they cannot do it in this country. They just won't do it because, quite frankly, a lot of the white people here are struggling too. So you're going to tell them to give up, you know, their tax or their benefits or their things to address, you know, a minority. They will pay lip service to it. You know, they'll post the little black squares. They'll say Black Lives Matter. They'll do all those little, they'll give us little things here and there. But to truly address that disparity is something that they will not do here simply because we're marginalized and we are a small percentage of their overall community. Now, in the United States, oddly enough, what you see is something very, very interesting going on. Because in the next 20 to 30 years, you're going to see the demographics of that country flip. It's going to flip.
Yeah.
And
what I, yes, it are.
It's flipping. Fear. You understand? And yeah, the blacks and the browns are going to be in the majority. And the together, whites are going to be, yeah, together. They're going to be in the majority, and the whites are going to be in the minority. And so a lot of things that can't be implemented in a lot of other countries, I mean, they'll never come out and say this, but a lot of things that they wouldn't do simply because of demographics in the United States, a lot of policies, a lot of, you know, different things are going to be changed simply because the demographics of the country are going to change, and you're going to be able to do things in your community. That's why the criticism of Barack Obama to me was never valid. They were like, oh, he was a black president, but he didn't do nothing for black people. How could he? How could he? You understand what I mean? The country is a majority white country, and you must cater to your constituency. Like, just in politics, this is what you have to do. And so, in my opinion, once the demographics flip in the United States of America, and it's the only country that that can happen in. It can't happen in no other country. There's no other country that possesses the demographics, whereas they're going to flip in such a way that, you know, the black and the brown will be in the majority, and they'll be in more control of areas of their land in a country that's already militarily, politically, economically at the top. It's a country that's already there. They already have systems in place that once these people are able to now get into positions of power, they're going to be able to delegate things in a completely different way that you're not going to be able to see in, frankly, here or in any other country. I just don't see a way in which that can happen. And so my hope is that we just exercise a little bit of patience. It's easy for me to say. It's easy for me to say that right now. But my hope is if you can just think long term and see the way things are going to happen. And I think there's a lot of people who know this, J-Bell. There's a lot of people in America who know this. This is why you see them wilding out right now. Yeah. While they are acting.
Some people understand it's their last stand.
And they can see it coming. And so they're like, oh man, they're fighting, they're doing everything. They're like, you ever seen like a fish when you throw a fish out of water flopping around? This is what they're doing right now. Because they can see, they're like, oh my God, this is going to change everything. And it's the only country I can see it happening now, man. And that is just, that's my theory, man. I may be wrong, but that's my theory.
We're having a conversation. I will say this, and you said a point and I totally agree with. And the point is this. When I look at this, we're talking about a wealth gap, a disparity in wealth, economic, socioeconomic mobility, right? Where you stand on that is what I'm looking at. And when I think about politics as a whole, who are they catering to? In a lot of countries, people with power are the ones catered to because of simple things like lobbyists. You know, it takes money to be elected. So once you're put on, right, and whoever puts you on, you owe a favor. Now you're trying to, when you're in your elected office, you're trying to do hopefully good for everyone, but there's favors to be made and had. I focus on American politics because that's where I truly, truly understand. So yeah, I think that when I look at this whole thing, the distribution of wealth has been the most significant factor on where we stand right now. And to your point, Black and brown people are the majority of that. So fits right into your narrative, but they aren't the only ones.
Yep.
And when you look at the UK as a whole, obviously we know the demographics, we know what they are as far as race, but as far as poor, that distribution is equally within all races, right?
Yep, absolutely.
So the focus needs to be, at what point do we understand this greed on the top level, corporate greed, individual greed, this impact it's having on society as a whole is unreal.
Get him, Jay Bell.
You know, it's, so what are we going to do? Because people are going to do one, the people are going to fight. People, listen.
Get him, Jay Bell.
If people understood, and if anything, COVID has shown this, what side of the fence you're on economically by your job. You might have had a good job that doesn't exist now, right? Where do you stand? And now it's all about that economic equality. Let's look out for our brethren, to our point before, because we all need each other in society, but we're going to have to redistribute this wealth. We're going to have to look after each other. Democracy and capitalism go together. But if capitalism is out of flux and isn't flowing right, it impacts your democracy. Your democracy will change. And the people right now are uprising against this. And once they collectively understand that, it's really about, where do I stand economically?
Rich or poor.
That's
having
it.
Money or not. Yep.
That's it, man. That's the game. In the US and everywhere else, they're getting behind all these different movements, but there's more to it. It's, I'm in this situation and nobody cares and I see it. I see it. They can't hide all this lip service, all this pretending, all this putting us in categories by the color of our skin. It isn't about that. It's pure economics.
Thank you.
We'll fool you into thinking you're this or you're that because you look like this and you sound like this. Money doesn't care what color you are.
Yep.
And we can get them to change. The volume of people can defeat money. People getting together in a democracy can stand up because of our vote, you know, because of the strength we have with that. And that's what protest does. That's why I hate what's happened to local newspapers.
Mm.
Because your local newspaper was the people that did the research on what's happened locally, what you have a problem with, and calling out people of power that try to squash that, that yep. try to operate in the dark. Those people that kept a check on society aren't around like they used to be. We have hot takes here and here everywhere with no real informative news, where we don't even understand what's happening. And those with the power love it because they operate in the shadows.
Yep.
Let's just peel back the onion. And let's see what's really happening, and let's dig, and let's spend the time to do the research to understand, continue to educate ourselves. And as a society as a whole, we can make moves. We can change the narrative. Politics shift. It's all about what the people demand. And I have so much hope in our society and our future because of the way young people as a whole have responded. I mean, people really, the majority of people care about people, man. And guess, in the USA, the number one economic driver is consumers.
Mm-hmm. That's
power.
I'm with you, bro. I'm completely with you, man. I am.
So
I share the same hope and optimism as you, but I also know that what's being fought against is so powerful.
It is.
And it's so insidious that most people can't even see it. You know, what you broke down here so eloquently, it's really about the haves and the have-nots. And the haves have found a way to separate the have-nots into fighting each other.
Yeah.
You understand what I mean?
Yes.
We found a way to.
Yes.
To I have, feel like I scored a goal.
Fighting each other instead of looking up and being like, "Hey, my friend, what are you doing there?
No. You guys keep fighting each other and stop looking at us."
And they've done that. And Jay, like, I promise you, like, I see these people in leadership positions, and people are looking at them all saying, this guy's an idiot, this guy's dumb. I'm like, nah, bro, this guy is brilliant. He's just brilliant in a different way, because they understand that as long as they can keep the focus on us dividing each other, they're always going to win. I look at our boy now, the president of the United States. I see him now, and all of a sudden, he's pivoted right now to how horrible Chinese people are. He's pivoted directly to that now, right? Elections are coming up. Oh, the Chinese are going to interfere with our democracy. The Chinese have brought the flu. The Chinese have done all this. He's doing all this simply because he knows that as long as the people in his base stop fighting and doing all this stuff, the attention is taken completely off of the stuff he's doing. And now it's on that nonsense now. And now it's as much as I hate to say it, it's genius. As stupid as it sounds, as ridiculous as it looks, it's like it takes a full understanding of how human beings are to operate like that. It does. It's crazy, man.
I'm always fascinated by our blindness. Like, and the problems it creates for us. If you don't understand your own blindness, you create so many problems for yourself.
This is the last thing I'm going to say about this, man. And it's going to drive home your point. Exactly. And I think me and you have discussed this before. But when I found this out, J-Bell, it really messed me up. It really did. Because I couldn't believe what I was seeing. Like, I couldn't believe what I was seeing. Because when this whole thing, started, I was like, man, what? I can't believe this, man. And then it started to occur to me. I was like, well, what have my experiences been? I can say that I've had maybe 5 encounters with police in my life, 5. 4 of them were good. And they were all white police officers.
Mm-hmm.
You understand what I mean? One of them was bad, but 4 of them were outstanding.
Were they in New York? Okay.
Hey, OC. Some tough situations, J-Bell. They really did.
Mm-hmm.
And so I started to think, I was like, okay, so if, police are just going around killing black people, unarmed black people willy-nilly, if this is what's going on.
It is what's going on.
Right. But check this out, though. I was like, so why haven't they shot me? Or professional athletes, or, rich black people? If it's literally about the color of your skin. One of us would have been killed by now. You understand what I'm trying to say?
Mm-hmm.
Or like a professor, like really highly educated, black people. Why are they not killing them? Wow, that's weird. So it can't necessarily just be about that, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I was like, okay, cool. So what is it then? What's going on? So I wanted to go do some research, and the research said, okay, black people are 2.5. This is in America now. Mm-hmm. It's in America. Black people are 2.5 times more likely to be killed by police than white people. I want you to remember that number, Jason, 2.5 times, okay? Black people are 2.5 times more likely to be killed by police than white Americans. And I was like, yeah, you see, this is what's going on. You are going around, willy-nilly just killing more black people because they're black. But then it still didn't sit right with me. So I was like, let me just do a little bit more research to try to fully understand. And this is why I found something, Jason, that when I found it out, I couldn't sleep for like 3 days. And later kept on asking me, she was like, what's wrong? It was stuck in my head, and I just couldn't sleep. Because here's the problem. I went to go look at the poverty rates, right? And I found that in America, the poverty rate of black Americans is 22%. So if you're black in America, you have a 22% chance of being poor in America.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're white in America, the poverty rate is 9%. So if you're white in America, the chances of you being poor, you have a 9% chance of being poor, right? Mm-hmm. So 9% for whites, 22% for blacks, right? You remember that 2.5 number that I told you about?
Mm-hmm.
If you multiply 9 by 2.5, do you know what you get?
22.
Isn't that something? Isn't that something? Isn't that something, J-Bell? They are literally killing black people at a 2.5 times higher rate because we're 2.5 times more likely to be poor.
Mm.
So the issue here really is poverty. And so can you imagine seeing something like that? Can you imagine, like, why would that number be so exact? Like, that's what I couldn't wrap my head around. I was like, why would that number be so exact?
Yeah.
Why?
People treat, throughout history, it sucks, but people treat people in different levels of society different.
Period.
I remember driving where I'm from, a friend of mine was a police officer, and I used to train in a pretty interesting part of the neighborhood, right? High school kids. And I said, you know, how am I in this kind of car, dark tent, not getting pulled over? And he goes, well, you got a license plate that says UCLA graduate. And he goes, we know who to pull over.
Yep.
And I never really thought about that statistically until you just said that. In the neighborhood where it's how they call it, shooting fish in a barrel. It's just like, go get them. Why am I not getting pulled over?
Yep.
Because I'm not perceived as poor.
Plain and simple. That's what we need to address, Jason. The poverty.
That would. Now, on another note, they wouldn't know I was poor if they knew how I made you pay for every dinner. But that's a whole nother subject.
That's incredible, J-Bell.
Oh, man. I missed you, bro. I missed you.
I missed you too, man. Holla at your boy. Yeah, Lee.
I know.
Let's do this again. Got to give them what they want, man.
Got to give them what they want, man. Shoot us with some questions next time. You know, I want some questions on just some obscure NFL questions. Like, ask us something just crazy. I'm willing to answer that now. I got time.
Let's do it.
All right. To all our people, Simon is still here. Oh, we see Simon again. He came back. Got a fresh little shirt on. Designed by an immigrant. I like that. I like that. You would be a guy in the locker room that we would play for. I'm just saying, you would be that kind of guy.
Ain't no doubt, man.
No doubt. We are out. The Jason and OC podcast. Holla at us. All right. See y'all. Now I got some collect. So far, never forget. Now money coming for X. I know they settle for less. The narrow got some collect. Gang got whips, whip. Man's got chicks, cash and flip, yeah. Man's got this, man's not vexed, man's got shh, ask my ex, man does bits, DBS, yeah. Man's got grills, VVS.